When I was a senior in high school, a long, long, long time ago, in our senior English class, our teacher, Mrs. Sled, who was barely 5 years older than we were, a recent graduate of Austin Peay, decided that she was going to initiate a group of country children, that would be us, into the wonders of English literature. I'm not sure if she came up on this idea on her own or if she was taught this in school. But the very first thing we did, the very first thing she required of us, was to memorize, stand before the class, and recite the prologue to the Canterbury Tales in Middle English. There is probably no more gruesome sound in all the world than a group of country children attempting to speak Middle English. But we did it. I can do it to this day, but you all look like a nice group of folks, so I will spare you. But I got interested in the longer story, not just the prologue, but all of these stories that get told along the way. And so when I was in graduate school, I had the opportunity to take an entire course in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales in Middle English. And so that meant that each time we arrived in class, we had to have certain portions translated from the Middle English into the Modern English. And I don't know if my professor was just taking pity on me or having a little fun with me, but he always asked me to translate the bawdy parts. Perhaps it was because he knew I would have them translated, although the other parts maybe not. And he knew that I would translate them for the class with great gusto and frankness. Whatever the case, I fell in love with these stories. In fact, just a few years ago, a very dear friend at Christmas time gave me a new translation of the Canterbury Tales. No, I do not sit around and read them in Middle English. Not unless I'm required to. They're about a pilgrimage. The people in these stories and the people who tell these stories are on pilgrimage. They are going to Canterbury in order to visit the shrine of a saint. Now, ideally, for all Christians, pilgrimage means you go to Jerusalem, right? But if you can't go to Jerusalem, you can go to the shrine of a saint. If you can't go to the shrine of a saint, you can use what we have here, a labyrinth. And walking the labyrinth is supposed to be a form of pilgrimage. And so this group of pilgrims that Geoffrey Chaucer is describing come from all classes of English society in his time. And though he starts with an upper class story, you might think he was going to observe the hierarchy of the society of his time, but it gets all mixed up by the time you get to the second story. And he uses these stories to offer a somewhat critical view of the society of England at his time and a somewhat critical view of the church at his time. On the pilgrimage, there is a contest among the pilgrims to see who could tell the best story. The reward at the end was going to be a meal, but Geoffrey Chaucer never finishes the Canterbury Tales. They are left incomplete, which may actually be a good thing. But along the way, we get to meet person after person and hear story after story and come to know not just individuals, but a whole society of people who are going to visit the shrine of a martyr, the holy, blissful martyr for to sake. That's why they're going. And if you don't believe that violent language can lead to violent behavior, that martyr was a man named Thomas à Becket. He was Archbishop of Canterbury. He got crosswise with Henry II, and Henry, in a fit of anger, said, "Who will rid me of this troublesome priest?" And so three of his knights decided they would do just that. They would go to Canterbury and they would rid him of this troublesome priest, Thomas à Becket, by murdering him. So if you don't believe violent language leads to violence, it has for a long, long, long time. So they're going to the shrine of this particular martyr, not just to remember his story, but like all pilgrimages, no matter where they lead, the destination is to an encounter with God. Now, they knew their destination. It was Canterbury. But as we read the story, they never quite arrive, do they? When we make pilgrimages to other countries, when we make pilgrimages to Jerusalem, ultimately our destination is to encounter God in a different way, in a different place. Just yesterday, we had a group of folks from West End who left to go to Haiti. They're going to be in Pignon working in a hospital. A year ago, right at this time, another group of us went. And believe me, you're going to encounter God in Haiti in a way that is radically different from any way you have ever encountered God before. You may think you know your destination. It may have a name. But believe me, that trip is full of surprises, as is every mission trip. I think every mission trip is a pilgrimage. Talk to any youth in this church or an adult who began going on mission trips as a young person and ask them about that experience, and they will tell you how transformative it is to begin to experience God in a very different place among very different people. A little later this month, there a group of us are going actually to Jerusalem and to the Holy Land. And while we basically know our itinerary and our destinations, we really have no idea how we will encounter God there in a culture and a time very different from our own, with people very different from those we know. Isn't it interesting that Jerusalem has become that kind of pilgrim destination for three major world religions, all of whom hold it as a place where you can experience God powerfully in new and amazing ways? And of course, instead of using that as a reason for cooperation and peace, we use it as a reason for conflict and hate, which I think dishonors the sacredness of that place. It says more about us as people than it says about God and encountering God in those sacred places. The original pilgrims, of course, were the Magi. You know, we don't know much about them. I don't know if you read Ray Waddell's piece in the Tennessean about the Magi. It's a wonderful piece. I would read anything that Ray wrote. He's a terrific writer. But he affirms what we have known for centuries, and that is we really don't know much about the Magi. We don't know exactly where they came from. We don't know exactly what religion there were. Oh, we've speculated. We don't know that they were only wise men. Magoi, the same word we get magician from, could include wise women as well. They certainly weren't kings, although we have given them that designation over the centuries. There weren't just three of them. There were three gifts, but the story never says how many there were. So we don't know a lot about these Magi that we celebrate today, that we celebrate in Epiphany. What do we know? Well, we know they were foreigners to the Jewish folks telling and hearing this story. We do know that they set out on a pilgrimage without knowing their destination. After all, they were just following a star, and they were going to stop wherever that star stopped. We do know that they were not of the same religion as the king they were seeking, who was a child at the time. They never expected, I'm quite sure, to encounter Herod, the king of the Jews, to encounter a king who, when he hears about their mission, seeks to help them to find out where this child is going to be born, and then promises that he'll come worship him in exactly the same way those knights worshiped Thomas a Becket. Because you see, kings don't like other kings being born in their kingdoms unless they happen to be their children. And sometimes they don't even like that. That's how power works. They certainly didn't expect to find this king they were seeking born in humble circumstances. According to Matthew, Jesus could have been up toward 2 years of age. He's living with his family in a house. They certainly didn't expect him to be as young as he was. Otherwise, why would they have brought those gifts? You don't bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh to a 2-year-old, do you? Who does that? They set out on a pilgrimage, trusting that they would have an encounter with this king who reflected the light and love of a God, of a religion not their own, that they would encounter God in that humble circumstance, not in the halls of power in Jerusalem, but in that humble circumstance in that house, and that warned in a dream that they were not to have anything else to do with Herod. They would go home by another way. You never encounter God and go home the same way you were. Ever. Whether it's on a mission trip, whether it is on a pilgrimage, we never encounter the living God and return by the same way we came. Because we are transformed by that encounter. The Magi were indeed those first pilgrims. And we're inviting you on a pilgrimage. You can read about it in the bulletin insert, but this is a pilgrimage that you've already been on for a while, but we're going to make it very concrete and real during Epiphany and during Lent. We hope you can join us Wednesday night. You're going to have a passport, and you're going to be able to get that passport stamped as you go on this pilgrimage. And it's going to be a pilgrimage, not necessarily out somewhere. Oh, you may travel. It's going to be a pilgrimage in somewhere to encounter that God who is present with us. Remember, that was Jesus' name, God with us. So that you can continue to grow and be transformed by the love that those foreigners found in those humble circumstances when they encountered the child Jesus. And it won't just be for a week or 2 weeks. It'll be for a season, actually more than one season. And you'll be invited to find God in the ordinary travels of your daily life. After all, a little bit later in this service, we're going to be asserting that you can come and you can find God in the simplest things in the world, the breaking of bread, the sharing of a cup, the sharing of a meal. God is there. You know, I don't think we can only find God when we go on pilgrimage. I think God is present with us at all times. It's just that when we are traveling, we open our ears and our eyes and our minds and our hearts to new experiences and different experiences. And that's when we are most receptive to encounter the God who is there always, who is with us at all times. So we don't actually find God so much as we become aware of that presence with us, always with us. And in pilgrimage, we open ourselves to that presence and that love, just the way the Magi opened themselves to the presence of God's love when they arrived at that house. Along the way, like Chaucer's pilgrims, we'll be telling stories too. We'll tell the stories of our lives. We'll tell them to each other. It won't be a contest. The meal that you'll be invited to, of course, will be the same meals we always serve, Wednesday night, Sunday morning. The hope is, however, that in those meals you will find a different experience of God, a more profound experience of God, the God who is with you always. So let me invite you to join us on this pilgrimage. Like the Magi, we are a pilgrim people after all. Let's be on our way.